Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and happy Valentine's Day. It almost seems a requirement to say that. Some holidays just become a part of our national consciousness. Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, the 4th of July, and yes, Valentine's Day. But February 14th does seem a little bit different. Let's face it, we are not celebrating a major national event or an historical figure's birthday, even though there is some sort of connection to St. Valentine. Let's be honest, Valentine's Day is largely a manufactured kind of holiday, the Hallmark holiday, if you will, best known for roses and jewelry and cheesy greeting cards and teddy bears gripping pink satin hearts that say I love you. Again, all good. Especially if you are one half of a couple. But of course, not everyone is, and not everyone wants to be. And that is the subject of today's program, why some people choose throughout their lives to live alone, and what our society has to say about it. My guest is Sasha Kagan, founder of a movement known simply as Quirky Alone. While most of us celebrate Valentine's Day, Quirky Alone celebrate International Quirky Alone Day. And Kagan has written all about it in her book, Quirky Alone, A Manifesto for Uncompromising Romantics. Sasha Kagan, welcome to Focus.
Hi, thanks for having me here today and recognizing Quirky Alone Day.
Glad to have you with us. As we begin our discussion about living alone, we welcome your questions and comments. Whether you live alone or not, I welcome your thoughts about what our society has to say about folks who do live alone, how our institutions may cater to or create barriers to people who are, for lack of a better term, uncoupled. Join the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or comment on our Facebook or Twitter pages. We are at Focus580. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Sasha Kagan, what is the Quirky Alone Movement?
So the Quirky Alone Movement is based on the idea of recognizing the quirky alone, basically. And so it's a word that describes people who are comfortable being single and even enjoy being single. And they may want to be in a relationship, but it really has to be the right one. So they're people who prefer to be single rather than dating for the sake of dating.
And how did this begin?
So it all started way back in 2000. So it's been with me and with the world now for about 13 years. I published an essay called People Like Us, the Quirky Alones, in my own magazine, a print magazine, actually, called To-Do List. And then Utney Reader, which was a compendium of alternative press, picked it up. And soon it just went viral without any real big effort on my part. And people just really responded strongly to the idea of Quirky Alone because it gave them a feeling of validation. And the common theme that I got in really thousands of emails and even mixtapes that people sent me, and it was just an avalanche of response, was thank you for showing me that there's nothing wrong with me. That, you know, people felt like there was really something weird about them if they had spent a good chunk of their lives single and that they had these standards for a romantic relationship and didn't want to settle. So the movement is really like identity, you know, identifying with others and feeling like you're part of a social moment that is bigger than just yourself, especially if your parents or others just don't get you and don't understand why your life doesn't look like theirs did.
So what do you mean by quirky alone? Why put those two words together into one?
Yeah, perfect. So, I mean, the quirky part is really celebrating and relishing your differences. And as far as quirky alone goes, it's a recognition that if you're not a cookie-cutter person, you probably can't sign up on an online dating site and immediately find your match, that it might take a while to find that person. So, and the alone part, it doesn't mean that you're alone in the sense that you are a loner or you want to live in a cabin by yourself. Quirky alones tend to be quite sociable people, although they can also have an introvert part of them. But friendship is really important for quirky alone. So the alone part is more like, this is my stand of independence. I'm willing to go to a wedding alone, even though the norm is to go with a couple, because I would rather go alone and be open to possibility versus fulfill society's expectation that I have to be in a couple all the time.
And what talk a little bit about, at least from your perspective, what those societal expectations are.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting thing for me because I've been writing about being quirky alone for over 10 years now, and I've seen some changes even in that time. I can tell you that when I was selling my book and first introducing this idea, there was a lot more resistance. And people, I mean, back then, a response from publishers was like, well, nobody wants to be single, and nobody's going to want to read a book that celebrates being single. And now I would say there's just so much more positive attention about the possibilities of being single today, and I think it's become much more common for people to say something like, it's much more lonely to be with the wrong person than it is to be alone. Like, that has just become more common. And that's not to say that there aren't still pressures. There are still pressures from parents, from family, from society, from media, from shows like The Bachelor. And worst of all, I think, is the pressure that people feel inside themselves, that there's still a judgment that being coupled is somehow a validation of you as a person. And I think that's especially true for women, that, you know, being in a couple, you learn when you're 12 years old, like, that makes you popular, that makes you valuable. So I think we're unlearning that our whole lives, that we can be just as valuable on our own.
You mentioned that you think this is something that maybe is a somewhat more intense pressure for women. You know, we used to call women that never got married old maids or spinsters. Do you think that perception still exists?
I think that perception has lessened a lot, and people can be envious of single women and all the opportunities they have to create their own lives and the freedom they have. But at the same time, I think that there is still a pity, and we haven't gotten rid of that completely. And there's always this kind of combination of the glamour and the pathetic. Like, Sex and the City was sort of like that, that it was an enviable life that Carrie had, but at the same time, everyone wanted her to be partnered at the end, and the comedy was always in her humiliation in different scenes throughout the show. So I think that there's still a double edge with that, and we haven't completely accepted the power of a single woman.
Let me play devil's advocate a little bit here. For people who have long been part of a couple, say someone married for decades, I imagine it is hard to consider life without that significant other. How would you describe to someone who has experienced all the joys and all the challenges and all the life experiences associated with marriage, why you would consciously choose a different path to not want to find maybe a partner in life?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that quirky alone is never an argument for perpetual singlehood, and it's not about being against marriage. A lot of quirky alones want to get married. But it's just that they don't want to get married just for the sake of being married. There's also the concept of the quirky together, which is in my book, and that's really about a new form of couplehood where we recognize the value that we've had in our single lives and that we won't want to lose all of that when we couple up with someone. And so that's especially true for people who marry later in life and have, you know, created independent lives on their own and don't want to merge everything necessarily. Like, maybe they don't even necessarily want to live alone, or maybe they want to have separate bedrooms or still be able to take a trip with a friend or have a friend of the same sex and not have that seen as cheating, for example. So, I mean, you know, having a partner is a beautiful thing. I want to have a partner. I mean, for me, single by choice, it's not really single by choice. It's the sense that I choose my life whether I'm single or I'm with someone.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. On this Valentine's Day, when many among us are planning romantic dinners, gifts, and so forth for that someone special, others among us are, well, not. Some 32 million Americans live by themselves. That number has been rising. We're considering the societal implications of more Americans choosing to live alone. We're talking with Sasha Kagan, founder of a movement known as Quirky Alone. Turns out today is also International Quirky Alone Day, and Kagan has written about it in her book, Quirky Alone, A Manifesto for Uncompromising Romantics. We welcome your thoughts about the trend towards more people choosing to live alone and to remain, for lack of a better phrase, uncoupled. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We're on both sites at Focus 580. And we'll begin this morning with Brian in Champaign. Good morning, Brian.
good morning. This is very interesting. I'll have to take a look at your book. This comes to mind. I'm not a quirky alone, but I just wanted to emphasize something. I studied Japan. My wife's Japanese, and she's always saying that one thing that really bugs her about the States in particular is the pressure for everyone to be in couples. She calls it couple culture. And you don't really find this in Japan. Interestingly enough, in Japan, if you're going to be married at some point, you may decide to, and you sort of see whether you're at this stage of your life, whether you feel ready financially and otherwise to do this. And sometimes you go with arranged marriage. Sometimes you go with romantic if you, you know, decide the time is right to really look for the right person. No one really sits around, you know, saying, well, where's your boyfriend? Don't you have one? Or a girlfriend, or whatever the case may be. And so she was kind of taken aback when she first came to the States and went to grad school and so on here. And, you know, there's just very, very clear pressure that someone, whether you go to a party or elsewhere, you need to be in sort of couple format. And this seems to be an extension of this, what you're talking about. In other words, that to reject that is viewed by society in some ways as quirky, right? And I just it seems just so ridiculous to me, but it's quite real, obviously, and an unfortunate, I think, aspect, particularly of American society. But maybe there are other societies that are like us, you know, that have this kind of pressure. But they certainly don't in Japan, and people often don't get married till they're in their early to mid-30s because, I mean, nobody really cares. I mean, you don't have to get married. And their friends are very, very central in their lives, by the way, in the Japanese case. And so you can just hang out with your friends. Men tend to hang out with men. Women tend to hang out with women. That's true in groups and so on. And so there are lots of differences, certainly. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. And I'm just wondering whether this is a kind of American thing and, you know, what your view is on that.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Sasha, is this, you think, a uniquely American culture, or is this something that is reflected in other countries?
I think that the answer is both. My book has been translated in Brazil and Denmark and Germany, and it's gotten media attention in many different countries. So I think that this kind of couple pressure is something that people feel globally. And it varies. There's a word in Japan that I uncovered when I was writing the book called wagamama, which is about a single woman being selfish, but they're reclaiming being selfish in a kind of ironic way and owning it. So I think that there are all kind of permutations. I'm in Argentina right now where I've been living for the last 4 months, and I was talking to some friends here about Valentine's Day, which is also today here. And they were like, oh, what, people get depressed about Valentine's Day if they're not couples in the U.S.? You know, we have other things to get depressed about. Like, that would be, like, really low on the level of things to worry about. So I think that we have a sort of particular culture around Valentine's Day in the U.S. that is very commercialized. In some other countries where I've traveled, it's a day of love and friendship. Dia de Amor y Amistad in Colombia, for example. So that's already like a little bit more like Quirky Alone Day, which is more of a open celebration of love in you know, kind of a more expansive way.
Some look at people who live their lives alone as leading easier lives. Others may see it as a less fulfilling life. And I guess still others would say anyone who would choose to live alone is living in some sort of denial that they must be lonely. How could they not be? What about that notion of, you know, you're just denying what is sort of the natural order of things to be part of a couple? That's the way it goes.
Well, first of all, the natural order of things is that we're born as individuals and we die as individuals. So you could argue that many different ways, but it seems we're naturally hermetic individuals first in terms of how we come into the world and how we leave. And then as far as what you said about it being more work to be in a relationship, it is work to be in a good relationship. And I certainly believe that. And I think that being in a relationship that's a really good partnership that brings out the best in both people is a very fulfilling way to live. And it takes a lot of work from both people to grow. And it's a great way to grow. And also being alone can be a great way to grow. There are ways that you can know yourself that you can only know when you live alone or when you travel alone or when you experience the world in that way. Equally, that there are ways to learn about yourself and grow when you're in a couple. So I think it's really about seeing both as valid and valuable. And that I think that, you know, people may miss out if they never have a chance in their lives to be single.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Sasha Kagan, founder of the Quirky Alone Movement and author of Quirky Alone, a manifesto for uncompromising romantics. We're discussing the prevalence of people in America today choosing to live alone and how society is, or in some cases may not be, adjusting. Whether or not you live alone, chances are good you know somebody who does. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the potential pros and cons of doing so, whether it's a good or a bad thing if society makes it easier for us to do so. And if you have purposely chosen to live alone, let us know why. Or call with other questions or comments you may have at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus580. The phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. I'm just going to continue on sort of the devil's advocate tack here for just a little bit further and then get into some other issues. But another concept that I imagine folks maybe toss your way from time to time is the notion that, well, you're young. You'll feel differently about this as you get older. Have you considered that?
Sure. And, I mean, this concept has been with me through my 20s and my 30s. And I think it absolutely does change as you go through different life stages. In some way, I think being in your 30s or early 40s can be one of the harder times to be quirky alone if you have an instinct toward having children, because unless you're really ready to go and do it by yourself, that's a time when there's a particular pressure and you're really reckoning with a decision that you can make only in that time of your life. I think in your 20s, it's a bit more romantic and, you know, it's kind of more abstract, like, oh, yeah, of course I'll be married when I'm 30 or 40 or whatever. And then the other thing that I think I've noticed was when I published my book, Quirky Alone, and did my book tour and all of my subsequent events for Quirky Alone Day, I've always been struck by how many people in their 60s come to the events or older, and that there's this whole phase of life after a divorce or after a spouse dies, where people are just really excited to develop this part of themselves. And, you know, when I started off with this, I was 25, and I didn't expect to be connecting with people in that age group. And it's, in a way, it's sort of like the younger people and the older people who can kind of go rah-rah quirky alone the most.
I want to come back to the question of this impact of this sort of lifestyle on older Americans. We'll get to that in just a little bit, but let's take another call. We have Amy on the line from Urbana. Hi, Amy.
Hi, interesting talk. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about structural influences within cultures that might support or complicate the ability to be a quirky alone. I know that in the U.S., there's a number of rights that come from being formally recognized by the state as being in a couple. So rights that protect your children as your own, rights that protect your property, being able to give insurance to each other. Like today in Illinois, same-sex marriage is being considered as a very viable option, which is very great, so people should contact their senators in support of that. But I'm wondering if you could speak, since you have a very international perspective on this, on how different cultures might make it easier or harder for people to choose this as an option. And I'll take it offline. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point, and that we have bound up many of our benefits in marriage. One of the chief among them is health insurance, where, you know, where Obamacare is being rolled out, and we'll see how far universal health care gets expanded. But it's very common for people to get health insurance through their spouse, and that can be a reason for people to stay together. And in a country where universal health coverage, where health coverage is universal, people don't have the same incentive to get or stay married. So that would be the case in a country like Sweden, for example. And even in many other countries where I've traveled in South America, health coverage isn't tied up to marriage in that same way. There was a recent article in The Atlantic that calculated the financial penalties of being a single woman, and the authors of that piece came up with something like $1 million, don't quote me exactly, but something like that over a lifetime in taxes and health insurance and some other factors. So I think it's definitely an issue, and more now, I would say 10 years later from when I started, people are really starting to take up that mantle. Whereas when I started talking about the Quirky Alone movement back then, it was sort of ironic and funny. And I didn't anticipate a quirky lawn march on Washington, but now I actually see people really taking those issues seriously of equality. That we're talking about same-sex marriage. Well, what about equality for people who are unmarried?
Let's take another call. Lori is on the line from Terre Haute. Lori, good morning.
Good morning. I really am interested in this topic, and I'll be 38 soon and have been alone for the most part all my adult life. And I really find that one of the kind of ironies is that my family relationships are actually deeper because I'm not coupled and I don't have kids. And so my relationships with parents and my relationships with my friends, I'm kind of the go-to aunt. And there's a level of intimacy with my extended family that I don't think I would have if I had an immediate family of my own.
Sasha, it's an interesting point that I guess if you don't have, if you're not one half of a couple, you may find that you develop even stronger ties to extended family.
Yeah, I think that that's really true, and it's one of the kind of hidden truths of being single that people expect or assume that being single means that you're lonely. But actually, people who are single are more likely to be involved in civic organizations, for example. That's one thing that Eric Kleinenberg, who's a friend of mine and a sociologist at NYU, released a book called Going Solo last year, and it's about the trend of people living alone. And actually, the data shows that people who live alone and people who are single tend to be more involved with their communities than people who are married. And in my original essay about Quirky Alone, I talked about the idea of significant others, plural, which is basically what your caller was just talking about, was, you know, the idea that we have multiple people in our lives who are important to us. And really this idea that we're going to have one partner who is everything, I think more and more of us are waking up to the idea of how unsustainable that is and how that's just not really a happy life. Even if you find a good partner, that partner can't be everything for you. So I think more and more of us do have this sort of significant others, plural, kind of life.
Lori, thanks very much for the call. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing living alone with Sasha Kagan, founder of the Quirky Alone Movement and author of the book Quirky Alone, A Manifesto for Uncompromising Romantics. Today is not only Valentine's Day, it's also International Quirky Alone Day, and you can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus580. You mentioned Eric Kleinenberg, the NYU sociology professor, in his book Going Solo, and the argument he gives in it that a lot of folks who live on their own have richer social lives than adults who are married or in relationships. It would seem, though, maybe this is counterintuitive, but it would seem easier for adults in relationships to have more expansive social circles because each is bringing their own social circles into the relationship. If they have kids, they may end up socializing with other parents. Why do you suppose it is it seems that those who live alone do have more expansive social lives? If he's
well,
right.
I mean, I think if you just think about a Friday night, if you have a partner and you get into a routine, you may just sort of assume that you're going to stay home and watch a movie on Netflix, for example. And if you're single, well, your life is really yours to create and your responsibility to create your social life all the time. So, you know, I think it's an impetus to reach out more. And of course, coupled people can have active social lives too, and they could be what I call quirky together and still have these significant others in their lives. I think there's a certain way that we can cocoon when we're in a relationship. And of course, if you have children, you have a lot of responsibility at home too. So, you know, you just might not have the same amount of time if you have young children, for example. And if you have a couple, well, yeah, there's this kind of resting, cocooning thing that happens.
Tony is on the line from Champaign. Good morning, Tony.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that this weekend on Book TV, I listened to a fellow, Jonathan Last, I believe his name was. He was talking about his book, What to Expect When No One's Expecting. And I know this isn't a direct isn't a direct consequence of what you're talking about, but the reason I bring it up, he was talking about the disaster, demographic disaster that's waiting the United States. And one of his examples was that, surprisingly, given your earlier call where the guy was kind of bragging about Japan and their attitude toward single people, he actually brought up that example as how desperate they are in Japan because of the low replacement rate. And, you know, they're having to look to robots and things like that, and he's predicting a real disaster over there and another one over here because people aren't having babies like they should. And I was wondering if your guest would comment on what her ideas, how they might impact our ability to replace ourselves and to be there for our older people. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Yeah, I guess, Sasha, one of the big questions is if too many people decide, oh, I'm going to hold out for that, you know, that perfect person, that perfect soulmate forever, and you know, in the most practical terms, we suddenly are not really repopulating our own species. I guess you could go too far in that direction, in theory.
I think in theory that's possible. It doesn't seem to be the case now in the U.S., and I can't cite you figures on the birth rate, but I think that we're still around two. But again, I don't have those at the top of my tip of my fingers. So, yeah, it doesn't, I mean, if anything, I know people are concerned about population growth, so it seems like that's a debate, that's a bigger debate.
But it's certainly that is part of and parcel of the sort of societal implications of deciding whether or not to spend your life with someone else, to have kids, depending on how society perceives that decision. I guess that can have an, you know, over time, it could have a long-term impact on population, one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, to speak about it in a more personal and down-to-earth way, you know, a lot of people might think that they should get married and have a child so that that child would be around to care for them when they get older. That would be the kind of personal implication of what the caller was talking about. But I don't think that's really a good way to live your life, you know, because we don't really know what the future holds, and I think that we should do things that we want to do. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are older and had children and still wind up alone, and Eric writes a lot about seniors living alone and that they actually prefer to live alone versus living with their families in his book, Giving Solo. So living alone is really something that people like. You know, it was surprising for me in reading his book how preferable that is for most older Americans.
Let's next go to Greg in Champaign. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I'm enjoying the conversation. I just wanted to clarify or get your opinion about I'm a single dad with kids, school-aged children, and so I'm alone, but I don't have too much of that freedom that you're talking about. Be able to sort of plan my life and enjoy all the options.
All right, Sasha, so that's another wrinkle in all of this. There are more single parents today than there were certainly 30, 40, 50 years ago. And so the implications for them, I guess, are different.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true that being a quirky alone parent is different than being a quirky alone non-parent, especially if you have primary responsibility and custody. So, I mean, yeah, it's not the same thing. But at the same time, the core of being quirky alone is really that you would prefer to be alone than to be with someone just for the sake of being with that person. So parents still gravitate to this idea, and I think it still speaks to them on a very core level. And our lives just change as we go through different stages and take on different responsibilities.
Greg, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Sasha Kagan, founder of the Quirky Alone Movement, author of Quirky Alone, a Manifesto for Uncompromising Romantics. We're discussing the prevalence of people in America today choosing to live alone and how society is, or in some cases may not be, adjusting. Whether or not you live alone, chances are good you know somebody who does. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the potential pros and cons of doing so, whether it's a good or a bad thing, if society makes it easier for us to do so. If you have purposely chosen to live alone, let us know why, or you can call us with other questions or comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. Find us on either at Focus 580. And we'll take more calls and emails and have more discussion after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking today with Sasha Kagan, author of the book Quirky Alone, A Manifesto for Uncompromising Romantics. Kagan, like some 32 million Americans, has chosen to live alone, something far fewer did in generations past. While some changing factors in our society may make it easier to live alone, we are exploring whether societal attitudes towards those who do have changed. We welcome your thoughts at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus 580. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. We have a tweet from Chris. He asks, what's an ideal International Quirky Day activity for a quirky together couple resisting the tyranny of Valentine's Day?
That's an excellent question. A lot of quirky togethers are attracted to Quirky Alone Day, too, because many, many people just don't like the contrived nature of Valentine's Day and the way it's loaded with expectations, and it seems like people are just not happy, like they just can't satisfy them. So Quirky Alone Day is a great alternative if you're in a couple. It's really a day, if you're together with someone, it's a day to celebrate your romance and your independence. So you're celebrating how great you are together and how great you are separately. So, you know, the thing about Quirky Alone Day is it's just totally open for you to create on your own, and I give a list of suggestions, like you could create a day that's partially together, partially alone. If you know the alone part, you can take a long walk alone. You can rearrange your furniture. You can buy yourself flowers. So it's really a chance to take care of yourself and your partner. You want to celebrate in a quirky together kind of way.
I hear a lot of parallels between this and Festivus. Festivus for the rest of us, for Seinfeld fans. Are there feats of strength? Is there a giant pole in the corner of the room?
If you want there to be one, there can be.
Okay.
That's the beauty of it. No one is going to tell you you're celebrating Quirky Alone Day in the wrong way.
All right. Next up is Mary in Urbana. Hi, Mary.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Well, thank you.
Good. Well, I had this memory of my dad, and I wanted to share it with you, and I was born in 1957, so in the later 50s, a lot of women would go to, like, the Elks, and there would always be a table of war widows, and my dad would always buy them a bottle of champagne, and it always made them feel so good, like they weren't just left behind, because I think back then women really didn't go out at all by themselves, and just the look of joy on their face was something that I have in my memories, and thought I'd like to share it with you.
Oh, what a great memory. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, bye.
Thanks.
I like your program. Okay.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. So any thoughts on that, Sasha?
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful, and certainly in the 1950s, it was much more stigmatized to be a woman on your own, or as your caller said, to go out as a woman alone. So I think that those gestures of inclusion are really a beautiful thing.
Do you think that stigma does still exist to some degree? I mean, you sort of alluded to this earlier, but do you think our culture looks a little differently at men and women when it comes to those who choose to live alone?
You know, I think that men don't have a completely easy time of it. I think that they face stigma and internal pressure also, but that it is easier for men because men can be seen positively, like, you get to be a bachelor and enjoy your freedom. And, you know, I think that those guys can still be seen as quirky, like quirky in a negative way, and be judged, but there's just much more space for other archetypes about being a man alone, like being a James Dean type and, you know, Odysseus going on a quest alone, that there are, in our culture, we just have many more archetypes of men alone that are positive.
And not so much for women, that there aren't similar positive archetypes?
Not really. I mean, it's always been my project to bring those archetypes out and to celebrate them. But it can be hard to think of those women at the tip of your, you know, at the tip of your fingers. They're not really there.
Steve is in Milford. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Joining the program rather late, so if you've covered some of this already, I apologize. Very interested in what the guest has to say. There was a book a number of years ago, and again, it's not a direct correlation, but the name of the book was Bowling Alone. And it was just about how I think, that, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, married for 25 years with two kids. I think in my dad's day, women had a lot less options, and life itself was much more structured. You know, you joined a club, you went out on Wednesday nights to the Elks Club or whatever you did. And now I think people are taking more responsibility for the direction of their own lives. And I don't get a sense of urgency. I have a niece who's 30 who has a very, very good job. And I don't see her interest, you know, where she has to get married, she has to have kids. I don't see that. And if she never gets married, well, that's fine with her. Because having kids is such a responsibility that just to reproduce so, you know, they take care of us, I think is probably the wrong thinking there. But what I was wondering about your guest, if you comment, did she at all sense any of this is born out of selfishness? In other words, making sure that I myself is happy first before anybody else, before I take responsibility for anybody else. And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. Sasha, what about that notion?
Well, I think that the word selfish is a loaded term, and it sounds really negative. What your caller just said was that people might want to be happy by themselves before they partner with someone or have children. And, you know, all of those things are leaps and risks that you take in life, but, I mean, that sounds like a good thing to me, that people want to be happy on their own, because a lot of people enter into relationships with the expectation that the other person is going to make them happy and makes that person responsible for their happiness. And that just doesn't work, you know. So, I mean, eventually the relationship will fall apart in different ways if you place that responsibility on someone else. So, you know, I think that that's a good trend.
What about the idea that the next step to take is to, once you've reached that point where you say, well, I'm happy and I'm satisfied in my life, the whole point of a relationship is to some degree sacrifice to the other person's happiness in some way, to say, well, I'm not going to do everything that I want to do, but there's greater joy in being able to provide for somebody else to enjoy, you know, what they want to do, and to sacrifice in that way.
I think that what you're talking about is a beautiful thing, and that's part of creating a union with someone, is to give to the other, and yet your priorities change because now the couple also is important. But I think what I'm talking about with being quirky together is that there's a different balance there, and that you don't give up everything that you like in order to be in a relationship, which might sound dramatic, but I think it happens a lot. And that you make sure that you keep alive your own passions, which may or may not include a partner. And that might not be the style of relationship that everyone wants to have. Some people want to be together all the time and make the couple the main thing. But I think many people are evolving toward a different style of partnership where there is more individuality and independence. And yes, you sacrifice for the couple, but the couple also supports the two individuals.
We talked earlier about older Americans, and there are more older Americans living alone today than in the past. According to the U.S. Census, about 10% of all households made up of people 65 and over those are people who live alone. Some of those are, of course, by choice, and some are not. What do we owe to senior Americans in terms of how the services we provide to them take into account the fact that so many do live alone now?
Yeah, I think that we owe senior Americans who live alone a lot, and it's going to require a whole change in the way that we think about our housing and our health care and community. Eric's book, Going Solo, is excellent on this issue. There's a whole chapter about senior Americans, and there were two things that stood out for me. One is that people really like to live alone, and it is by far their preference over a nursing home or assisted living, and it is their preference over living with children. And when people get used to their independence, they want to maintain it. And secondly, there are many sad situations where people are not getting the kind of support that they need to get food, for example, or health care. And there, we need to think about more in-home supportive services. By coincidence, my mother has actually created a program like this in Rhode Island that pays family members to be caregivers at home for older Americans, which is much cheaper than sending them to live in institutions. So yeah, it's going to require a lot of creativity and commitment on the part of our government and leaders to look at this trend, and that we're going to need to support people in living alone because this is what they want to do. And it can be cheaper than putting them in nursing homes or assisted living.
There's another category of folks that we haven't really talked about. There are some people who simply struggle to forge relationships, romantic or otherwise. For instance, those maybe diagnosed with conditions such as Asperger's, maybe someone who suffers from an anxiety disorder, may not choose to be alone but may struggle to develop those lasting relationships. Do we as a society do enough to support them?
That's an interesting question. I think being in a relationship is actually quite a growth experience for everyone, and that all of us can really benefit from learning skills of partnership and how to show up and stand for ourselves and stand for the other person. So I'm not sure exactly what kind of resources should be available for those people, but I think in general we could all benefit more from learning how to be in a relationship. Like, it's not something that we get in health class, for example. So, while I'm a complete proponent of living alone and being single, I'm also a proponent of great relationships, and I think that that's an education that we all learn through. We learn through our lives, and it's great for people to learn more about how to be in relationship.
Let me ask you a practical question. I understand you travel a lot. You're in Argentina today. You travel to other nations. There is a common perception, particularly in regards to international travel, but I guess in travel of any kind, that it's not always safe to travel alone, that you are, I guess, maybe more of a target. Are there such perils to not being coupled to think about?
Well, there was the recent flap in the media about the young woman who was killed in Turkey, and she was traveling alone, and there was quite an hysterical reaction about it from some people saying that women, it's not safe for women to travel alone. And this is just wrong. Every person will decide about their own what's comfortable for them. But I've traveled alone in South America and Europe for a total of, if you add up all the periods of time, for 2 years. And I almost always feel safe. Nothing bad has ever happened to me. And people always go out of their way to help me, which I think is a benefit of being a woman traveling alone. It's been quite interesting to see the reaction to that woman's death, and that it almost seems sort of like a backlash of what I would call the anti-Quirky Alone movement, where like every so often in our country this voice can rise up that really wants women to be back in their place, to say that, yes, women can travel alone, and it's a very rich and rewarding experience, and for me it's been entirely safe.
Are there particular factors that you would say have more than others driven the prevalence of more people living alone? Certain things about where our society has gone in the last 20, 30 years that are sort of helping to make that shift occur a little bit?
Social factors that are supporting living alone?
Yeah.
For one, the liberation of women and the economic independence of women is the biggest factor, I think. I mean, that is what drives the emergence of Quirky Alone as a mass phenomena and in living alone. So I think that's the biggest one.
I imagine one of our callers alluded to the book Bowling Alone, which goes back to the year 2000. Robert Putnam wrote that. At the time, he was talking about this sort of disconnect that people have from family and friends and neighbors, and ways to reconnect. Of course, in the years since, communication, you know, just continues to skyrocket. Our ability to be accessible to one another instantly is, you know, greater than ever before. And I wonder if that's also had some impact, that people don't feel, you've been talking about the idea that living alone doesn't mean that you are lonely. Well, I wonder if that's part of it, that this notion of, well, you're always connected to a lot of people, or can be very easily if you wish to.
I think that's certainly true, and especially in the last 10 years, the emergence of social media as a huge part of our lives and the growth of the internet has changed what it means to live alone and made people feel more connected and more disconnected. In my opinion, we're living a big social experiment right now where we don't really know how it's all going to turn out, but certainly the internet has created ways to connect and has created all different ways for people who are different from the norm to feel more normal, because we've been able to find the other people who think like us and feel like us, and, you know, so we don't have to feel isolated like we did in the bowling alone era, where, you know, you could only join the bowling club and those people might not have shared your views.
Does geography play a factor as well? I mean, are we finding that there tends to be more people that live alone living in cities versus rural areas?
It is more of an urban phenomenon. In New York, for example, almost half of the households are single dwellers. And cities are just set up that way. Unfortunately, the housing in suburban areas may not be as accommodating for people who want to live alone. They might, you know, it might be harder to find a one-bedroom apartment, and the services are not as close by. So the architecture is still built with this kind of suburban nuclear family ideal.
How about institutions? I mean, I think of things like, you know, going to the doctor. If you know, let's say you go to the eye doctor and you get drops put in your eyes, well, you kind of need somebody there to drive you home, that kind of thing. I bet there are probably a number of examples like that where maybe just the way we've sort of organized our society still kind of is geared towards this idea of at least a couple, or having other people in your life that are sort of immediately accessible.
Yeah, I think it's true. You're talking about kind of the emergency contact that you put on a form.
Right.
And who is that person? And, you know, I think living this life requires you to really reach out and create those connections with people. And, you know, that can be part of the shame factor for people. Like when you look at that form, oh, I'm supposed to have a husband to put here, or, you know, that kind of thought could come up. But really, it's about taking responsibility for your own life and creating those close relationships and connections, and, you know, asking a friend, will you be my emergency contact, and giving value to that relationship.
All right, finally, I have to ask, what happens when you do find your soulmate and become one half of a couple? Is that the end of the road for you as a quirky alone role model?
I think I'm going to become a really big quirky together role model, and I'm looking for someone who can model the ideal quirky together life with me.
And what does that mean? Define that from your perspective.
Well, for me, that means that we have a really strong, passionate relationship, and we support the relationship, but we also support each other as individuals, and it's okay if I want to go off and travel for a month by myself or with a friend, or, you know, it's okay if he has a passionate hobby that takes him somewhere else for some period of time, that, you know, we sort of like really model a relationship that supports both people being strong individuals.
Well, I guess I should wish you both a happy Quirky Alone Day, and if you want, a happy Valentine's Day, too.
I'm not really against Valentine's Day, but I just prefer Quirky Alone Day.
And I wanted to ask that before we let you go. How do you feel about Valentine's Day? I mean, are you sort of ambivalent about it, or, you know, see it as a positive, or do you think that maybe sometimes the negatives outweigh the positives of having a holiday like this?
You know, I think before I started Quirky Alone Day, I always did have I had a bit of an excluded feeling about Valentine's Day, and more often than not, I didn't have my perfect partner to be with, and I felt like, oh gosh, just another Valentine's Day, and when I did have a boyfriend, it felt a little bit like pressure. So I can't really say that I like Valentine's Day. There are other countries that have more of a day of love and friendship, and that feels more expansive to me, and I like that better. So I'm not against Valentine's Day, but it's not my favorite.
So what are you doing to celebrate Quirky Alone Day today?
So to celebrate Quirky Alone Day, the big thing is I'm launching a new course online called Get Quirky, which is to help people celebrate the quirky parts of themselves. So it can be about this kind of quirky alone part, but also all quirky parts of themselves, and to have fun with it. So I'm actually having quite a work-oriented Quirky Alone Day, getting that going. And then I'm hoping to go to a march, actually, for the 1 billion rising in here in Buenos Aires to dance against violence against women.
All right. Sasha Kagan is founder of the Quirky Alone Movement and the author of Quirky Alone, A Manifesto for Uncompromising Romantics. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's program was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.